As we were talking yesterday about the progress that has been made in medical science and halacha over the last couple of years, I was struck with what Rabbi Apfel mentioned about how Hashem creates the refuah before he creates the makah, that together with all these wonderful advances, there's been another tremendous advance, and that has to do with the technological advances in computers. Okay? In particular, such things as being able to do a Google search, a PubMed search. As somebody who started doing research back in the days of Index Medicus, okay, I truly appreciate that. And having work such as the Encyclopedia Rifuit Hilchatit of Rabbi Dr. Steinberg and Project Hashut, I have 3,000 years plus of Jewish history on a disk on this laptop, really puts the ability of somebody to work in this field and be interested in it while still trying to practice medicine. So we should give credit to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that advance as well. My specific topic now is going to be the use of medical intervention for gender selection. Now, this is readily available already on a commercial basis, okay? I mentioned the internet. A simple Google search will list many clinics who are willing to offer this service for a fee of mere thousands of dollars. No ethical questions asked. The goal of the current session is to ask those ethical questions, first within general medical ethics discussion, and then the unique issues that are raised within Jewish medical ethics. It is technically possible to select for gender at four different stages, all of which actually go on around the world. The first is preconception, before the union of the sperm and the ovum. The second is postconception, but before implantation. The third is after conception, but before birth. And the fourth is after birth. At the stage of preconception, there are a number of techniques. The first has to do with the timing of marital relations, according to Dr. Shettles, because sperm carrying a Y chromosome are lighter, they are faster. Therefore, in order to increase the chance of having a boy, one can have relations just prior to ovulation. For a girl, one should be having relations 3 to 5 days prior to ovulation. The O plus 12 method says for a girl, one should actually have relations 12 hours after ovulation. One problem with these methods has been that other than in articles which are authored by Dr. Shettles, they have pretty much been proven not to work. The other problem from a Jewish perspective is that they require having relations a number of days prior to ovulating, which can be problematic in many couples in relation to the timing that is permissible by Hilchot Nida, or the laws of the timing of marital relations within Jewish law. The remaining methods, sperm separation flow cytometry, require processing the sperm before artificial insemination. In sperm separation, the method is based on the Y sperm being faster. Sperm are placed in a test tube on top of a column of layers of albumin and allowed to swim down the column. The fraction of the column that contains the desired sperm is used for artificial insemination, or more usually for intrauterine insemination. And for having a girl, the mother also takes clomiphene citrate. The method is widely used, with authors claiming 78 to 85% chances of having a boy and 73 to 75% success if the desired gender is a girl. But other finds, when they actually check this processed sperm, that they're still 50-50 X and Y. And articles by researchers other than Erickson have been unable to reproduce this claim. The last method, however, is a method that has been shown to be effective in cattle. It is based on flow cytometry, using the fact that X-bearing sperm are heavier than Y-bearing sperm. It's been shown to be somewhat effective, with 76% of babies born after sorting for the Y are male, and 91% of the babies born after sorting for X are female. Now, the issue of efficacy actually is a halachic issue. As we see here, now you can actually see the Hebrew, which is why we switch laptops, Jewish law includes the discussion of business ethics. Making a false claim regarding a product is clearly prohibited, as indicated by the Shulchan Aruch in 222. Furthermore, overcharging for a product falls under the prohibition of ona'ah. One could argue that charging $1,200 for a product that does not work, at least in the sperm preparation methods, is forbidden for this reason. I think it's also a question to bring up about the umbilical, banking as well. However, in the case of microsort, if the couple is willing to spend $4,000 to increase their odds by about 20%, there are still halachic concerns, which has to do with the obtaining the sperm sample. Production of a sperm sample raises a halachic issue of hotza'at zera levatala, the expulsion of sperm into anything other than the vaginal canal. As one can see in this slide, the Shulchan Aruch rules that this is a very serious transgression. Furthermore, in general medical practice, the samples are often obtained by self-stimulation. This practice is frowned upon by the halacha, as we see in the Talmud in Nidah 13b, where it is learned from the prohibition of adultery. The prohibition is brought down as halacha in the Rambam in the Laws of Forbidden Relationships, chapter 21, verse 18. These issues have been dealt with extensively in the halacha's literature when procurement is needed to diagnose or treat infertility. It is important to note that while most poskim will ultimately permit semen procurement to alleviate the significant suffering that accompanies infertility, it is only after significantly grappling with the serious prohibitions involved and suggesting alternate methods of sample production. It's not clear that gender selection alone would warrant these leniencies. Post-implantation gender selection basically means abortion. This is actually the most common form of gender selection currently going on worldwide. Although technically illegal, it has been documented both in India, where providing girls with a dowry is expensive, and in China, which has a one-child-per-family policy, pregnant women undergo ultrasounds for gender determination and then simply abort the females. Abortion is difficult to permit under Jewish Torah law, even in the face of significant genetic conditions. Therefore, it's fairly clear that abortion for the purpose of gender selection is not permitted under Jewish law. The same is clear for infanticide, as killing an infant is clearly murder in Jewish law. This leaves us with what is known as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. We will now take a few minutes to explain the technique, and then we'll discuss it further. To perform PGD, one first needs to have the embryo handy before implantation. At present, the way to do that is to make sure that the embryo is conceived via in vitro fertilization, or IVF. As illustrated here, the process involves obtaining sperm from the husband in the manners we've already discussed, and then from the wife by harvesting her ovum. This is generally done under sedation to prevent inadvertent moving during the harvesting, and is usually after the wife has been given medication to cause superovulation so she will produce more eggs for harvesting. A needle is then inserted into the ovary and the eggs are drawn out. The gametes are allowed to join in the laboratory and embryos are produced that can be tested. IVF itself raises a number of halachic issues. One is the procurement of the semen sample, which we've already discussed. Another is the issues of maternity and paternity, which is currently being discussed. And in our particular case, however, we're not usually talking about donor gametes, so it's less of an issue. As most poskim are clear that when both the birth mother and the genetic mother are the same person, she is still the mother. Rav Waldenberg has questioned whether IVF confers paternity even when the sperm is to the husband. However, his opinion is mostly in the minority. Another potential issue is the issue of interfering with God's plan. This has been mentioned a few times. And this has actually been raised as one of the most significant concerns by some other religions, but seems to be less of a problem in Judaism. A English translation of this particular story is found in your source sheet. And it's a Talmudic source, which I think gives us another view in terms of how the Torah views us intervening, so to speak, in God's work. It starts with a question that was asked by Tunis Rufus to Rabbi Akiva. He says, if God loves the poor, why does he not support them? And Rabbi Akiva answers, so we can benefit from this. So we can be saved from Gehinnom. We can get the mitzvah points by giving tzedakah. The Roman answers, just the opposite. You deserve Gehinnom for intervening in the will of the king. And I'll give you a mashal. I'll give you a parable. If a king is angry at his servant and he puts him in jail and he says no one is supposed to feed him and somebody goes across him and feeds his servant, the king's going to be furious. And you, in fact, are compared to servants of God. Rabbi Akiva answers him, wait, I'll give you another story. If the king imprisons his son and he tells nobody to feed him and nobody to give him water, and somebody goes against him, is not the king going to be happy like this that somebody actually saved his son? And we, in fact, are called God's children. Another often quoted pasuk to discuss this has to do with the commandment that was given to Adam and Eve, that they should be fruitful and multiply, and to conquer the world and rule over the rest of creation. Rest of creation. 14 years in Israel, you can't speak either language. Sorry. The Ramban explains that Hashem gave them dominion over animal, vegetable, and mineral to do with it as they desire. Okay, this is in Bereshit 1:28. I will point out, however, that in Bereshit 2:15, where he put them in Gan Eden, le'ovda u'le'shomra, he also put some limits. Yes, we have the ability to deal with God's creation for our benefits, but it's supposed to be for the good. It's supposed to be to protect the world, not just to destroy it. Okay, so with that philosophical background not being a problem, let's talk about some of the techniques that are actually going on and what's involved. Our next step after the IVF is actually to test the embryo. They can be tested at a number of stages. The most common is testing at the blastomere or egg cell stage, which is the picture that you see here. The zona pellucida, which is a sort of shell that is surrounding the embryo, is pierced, and one or two cells are removed for testing. The testing is completed by day 5, and when the embryos of the desired gender are implanted. There's another possible technique, which is called blastocyst biopsy. Here one waits to a slightly further development of the embryo, and the embryo is already multiple cells that have differentiated to the point that there's a more outside layer of cells. Here also the zona pellucida is punctured at the third day, and then a small amount of this outside bulges out, and it's tested. Right? The problem is that the testing doesn't actually start here till about day 5, which is the day that you want to re-implant the embryo. And since what we're trying to do is prevent eventual abortion of the embryo, should it have the undesired characteristics, that could be a bit of a problem because you're putting it back before it's even tested. One possibility is to freeze the embryo and implant it in another cycle, though that raises a problem of putting a woman through procedures on two different cycles, which often involve hormones. However we get our sample, the actual way that there are a number of methods that are used for testing for various genetic diseases, when all we basically want to know is this an X, does it have X chromosomes or Y chromosomes? What's generally used is fluorescent in situ hybridization or FISH. To describe it, basically one uses a probe DNA that has fluorescence, has been given the ability to fluoresce. One then takes that DNA apart, has it joined together with the DNA that one is looking for, and then one gets a picture that lights up. And if you, for example, put in a probe for the X chromosome and the cell that you tested lit up, you know that this particular embryo is female. Now, regardless of the method of obtaining the genetic material, it's very, very small. There has been a lot of discussion about this in general medical ethics. Right? And this is the following is a summary of the issues that have been raised in the general discussion. Arguments against allowing any form of medical intervention for gender selection include that it could potentially lead to gender imbalance. And the example that's usually used is India and China, where there are more girls around than would be possible by chance, which over time may have implications in terms of lack of men. This seems to contribute to gender discrimination. Is this not the first step of a slippery slope where we'll not only be testing for the gender, we'll also be testing for other characteristics? There are risks involved in the procedure, having to do with the medication, the anesthesia that the mothers are going through, and the costs. Those who argue for say, while there may be an issue of gender imbalance in the third world, this does not seem to be an issue in Western countries. When you go and look at fertility clinics, parents in Western society seem to choose an equal amount of boys and girls. We can do legislation to prevent going down that slippery slope. Why all of a sudden are we worrying about the risks here when we have taken egg donation to be no problem whatsoever, and there we're putting women who themselves are not sick at all through these exact same procedures, and we don't seem to have much of an ethical difficulty there. Cost should not be an issue because this is people praying privately. This is usually not something that is covered for insurance. It's their money. They can decide what to do with it. We don't seem to object to cosmetic surgery. And once again, autonomy, autonomy. People should be able to make their own choices. Now, the ambivalence of this technology can be seen in the position statements of major medical organizations. In 1999, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine ruled that the social risks of IVF, followed by PGD, outweigh the social benefits, and therefore the procedure should be discouraged. The reasons that were given were, this identification of gender seems to be putting too much of an emphasis in gender as being something of value, as a reason to value one person over another. This could further contribute to gender stereotyping. They did not feel that it was reasonable to undertake IVF for this purpose, and it seems to be misallocation of limited medical resources. 2 years later, in 2001, the same body ruled that when the procedure was not IVF and PGD, but was preconception gender selection, mostly talking about the microsort method, gender selection for non-medical reasons is an ethically appropriate medical procedure if the method is safe and effective, the parents are fully informed of the risk of failure, parents affirm that they will accept a child of the opposite sex, they are counseled unrealistic behavior expectations, in other words, a sign they want to have a girl just because girls are easier to raise, they should meet some families that are actually raising girls. And also the parents themselves should be offered to participate in research about what might be the long-term outcomes of this kind of choices. Now, the Institutional Review Board had problems with what the Ethics Committee said because they said, wait a second, why all of this? First of all, there's a contradiction here, okay? We're talking about on one thing saying gender selection is not good, and in the other case, and gender selection is good. And it seemed to them unethical that we are giving people access to one technology, in other words, the preconception, and not giving them access to the second technology, in other words, the preimplantation. They felt this was even more unethical because it's the preimplantation that has a much higher success rate, okay? A, in terms of pregnancy right after the procedure, and B, in terms of being sure you actually got the gender you selected. So the chairman of the Ethics Committee answered the Institutional Review Board by saying that, in fact, the program might ethically offer pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for the purpose of gender variety when there's a good reason to think the couple is fully informed of the risk of the procedure and is counseled about having unrealistic expectations about the behavior of children of the preferred gender. His letter raised quite an uproar, and therefore he had to give a follow-up letter saying that the need for gender variety in a family does not at this time justify the use of IVF and PGD for that sole purpose. IVF and PGD for the first child should be discouraged. IVF and PGD for gender variety should be discouraged. And the primary reason that is given for this is because, and what's the difference in pre-implantation and preconception, that in IVF and PGD, we're creating embryos and we're destroying embryos, something that is not going on with the sperm selection. It's actually interesting that in general medical ethics, this is such a central thing. This is partially influenced by the opinion of the Catholic Church on the status of embryos, and it's probably one of the things that is less of a problem within Judaism, because pretty much most people agree that embryos outside of the human body are not considered life, and therefore, while they should be just treated with a certain amount of respect, they can be destroyed. Okay, it's still up in the air there, even though the statements are against it, because there are still ethics saying we just can't figure out what the problem is. Okay, we have the article, for example, by Steinbach in the Hastings Center, saying sex selection is not obviously wrong, and Dr. Hyde, male or female, we will create them. The Ethics of Selection for Non-Medical Reasons, Ethical Perspectives, where he basically just can't figure out why there should be a problem. At the moment, there's still, most of the organizations are still against it, both in Europe, in England, an ACOG statement, even if the ASRM says, well, maybe sort of should be discouraged, the ACOG Committee on Ethics says the only reason for IVF and PGD for gender selection is when the purpose is to prevent a sexually linked genetic disease. Now, Israel is actually one step ahead of many of the international organizations, that there actually is room within the system to allow gender selection, not only for sex-linked genetic diseases, in cases where there is real and present damage to the mental health of the parents of children to be born. There have been at least four children of one gender and none of the other, except for some very rare and idiosyncratic cases, which we'll discuss, proper counseling, and also a caveat put there that the couple agrees that if they have none of the gender that they want, they will go through with the pregnancy from the excretion from the embryos anyway, okay, to sort of get around the issue of not making embryos for no reason whatsoever. Now, from a halakhic point of view, the fact that we are selecting for gender in and of itself does not seem to be an issue. Throughout the Talmud, and these are sources two through five, a number of advice methods are given for assuring that one can choose the gender of one's child. There's also the Midrash of how Leah prayed for her male fetus, the future Yosef, to be turned into a female, known as Dina, maybe why I remember it. Her prayer is answered, and this story is brought by Rashi in praise of Leah, not in denigration, even though what she was trying to do was change the gender of her fetus. However, note that in all these sources, we are prescribing permitted activities. And in fact, most of them are laudable activities, such as havdalah, marital relations, charity, and prayers. Using PGD, however, is not that simple. We've already discussed many of the halachic problems engendered by IVF, such as a sperm procurement, and you have the same problems when the IVF is combined with PGD. Another is the issue of risk. Okay, there are documented risks to mothers who are undergoing in vitro fertilization, such as the ones that are listed here. There are dangers that have been found in children that are born after IVF. And risk is a true halachic issue. All right? The pasuk from which this is learned is a pasuk in Devarim about putting a fence around your house so nobody should fall off. And the Shulchan Aruch rules quite clearly that this refers to removing oneself from any danger, and that if somebody puts themselves in danger, they have managed to transgress two mitzvahs in the Torah, both a mitzvah taseh, a positive commandment, and a mitzvah lo taseh, a negative commandment. On the other hand, you know, in the cases of in vitro fertilization for the treatment of infertility, we do allow these procedures because of the virapo yirape, because of the imperative to heal people. However, it's not. The question remains if we can push this concern aside when the purpose is to produce a child of the particular gender. I think that serious thought has to be given to educational interventions if the lack of family balance can produce the same degree of psychological stress as infertility. Now, some have claimed that Judaism has an additional push for gender balance for the fulfillment of the commandment of pur ravu, of being fruitful and multiply. I think, however, it's useful to look at what the mitzvah of pur ravu really is. It is not fulfilled just by having a boy and a girl. You're not off the hook till your boy and a girl has had a boy and a girl themselves. And therefore, it's pretty clear that it is something to strive for, but it's not totally up to us if we are going to succeed. Furthermore, the Talmud in Shabbat 31a relates that at the end of one's life, one is asked if one has engaged in pur ravu, and not if one has reached its ideal fulfillment. To require ongoing attempts at having children spontaneously is one thing. Assuming a need for what extraordinary measures is another. Furthermore, while fulfilling the mitzvah of pur ravu is one of the considerations in halachically permitting contraception, it's not the only one. And therefore, to go to extreme measures of IVF and PGD to allow somebody to use birth control because they've gone for a review is probably going a little bit too far. Now, two idiosyncratic issues that have come up in Israel and where PGD for gender selection has been permitted. This would never come up under general medical ethics. This is only with halacha put in. Was wanting to produce, a couple was having a child through donor sperm, itself another halachic issue, and therefore the child would not, the father was a Kohen, and if this child would be a boy, he would not be a Kohen. And therefore, when it comes to the kid's bar mitzvah and his Ali and everything, all of a sudden everyone would know the story, which would be very stressful for the family, and therefore they wanted a girl. There also was a similar story, not from Israel, of couples who wanted to specifically have a boy, so there would be no problems of yichud, of being together with the father, because he could be related, so they specifically wanted to have a boy. Now the last thing I want to touch on, and of course in the time allotted one can't get to everything, we talked last night in terms of general medical ethics and Jewish medical ethics. In a recent article that came out in Akdamot, Harav Yuval Shurlo actually started using halacha to try to teach certain things in general medical ethics. Okay? And he used sex selection as his test case and taking another number of halachic principles to see how these can be worked in to the discussion of the argument of slippery slope. Okay? One of his things is engo zrim zera ala tzibur she'en tzibur yachol la'amod bo. Okay, that we do not make a decree that the community cannot manage to hold. Of course, there's a discussion, which is the community. If you mean the general community, most families can get away without having to deal with PGD and IVF. But if you're looking specifically at the community of people who are already stressed, well, then they have other considerations. Second of all, he says that there are times where, if it's not common, then Rabbanan did not feel that there was a need for a separate gezeira, a separate decree, and he's talking about a decree to prevent the slippery slope. If there are other methods of stopping it, then they didn't feel a need for a gezeira, though he has real questions about whether legislation alone can stop the slippery slope. And I think, you know, the story of euthanasia should give us pause. I think about things that I know when I were in medical were completely not allowed, which, you know, are now okay. You know, in Holland, you can now do euthanasia. And the last is hefsed merubah. In other words, in terms of dealing with the amount of stress that is being caused, in terms of the amount of need for allowing something and taking the risk of the slippery slope. So I think it's one of the things where I can't say the end. I can just say stay tuned because many things may change over the next couple of years as this issue gets discussed more. Thank you.